All right, and we are off and running. I better quit fooling around over here and get hot. Hi, everybody. Talking Fugitive one more time on KSAV. And tonight, well, it's the Fugitive, I guess, a little bit different. Fugitive 2000. And this will be part one of a two-part discussion on that topic. If you want to join in, you can do so, 800-407-KSAV. Or, you know, a way to become permanently involved in the discussion is to become a member of the Fugitive Views and Reviews, a Yahoo discussion group. And to do that, why, go to Yahoo Discussion Groups and search that in. And in doing so, you will come across the lead moderator himself, Bobby Neer.
Thank you, Dave. The success of the 1993 feature film version of The Fugitive and the mega millions it makes, and indeed continues to make today for its creators, only guarantees one thing, that it still isn't enough. And before you know it, well, actually, it takes 7 years, a new production company, well, actually the same one that did the movie, decides they will bring it back to TV, this time on a different network, CBS. 2 weeks from tonight, we will discuss a few of the more or less memorable moments of the new old series. But before we ever get there, tonight we need to talk about just who is going to dare to recreate characters so indelibly etched into the memories of millions. When I first heard about it, I scoffed at the very idea. If you can't get the originals, then why bother? And you sure can't get the originals. David Janssen is dead. And if he wasn't, he would be nearly 70 years old. Barry Morse is around, but he's even older than that. And Bill Raisch, the infamous one-armed man, has been gone as well for many years. I scoffed at the very idea and announced I would never watch a single minute of such nonsense. And when CBS announces they are going through with it and have found replacements in the form of Tim Daly, best known for a handful of TV and feature film roles, mostly comedy, namely the long-running sitcom Wings, and an African-American actor with the funny name of Michael T. Williamson, best known only for playing Bubba in the mega movie hit Forrest Gump, and a man named Stephen Lang who doesn't really have only one arm like the original did, well, I'm sure I've made the right decision. I want no part of this. I have not seen The Fugitive on TV for over 30 years. I watched but did not particularly like the movie version, and I've been happy for decades with my memories of the series, in spite of the bad moments that we have chronicled for 3 years now on this radio program, and how Tuesday nights back in the 60s has become the best night of the week. Can't you just let an old man go wandering off into retirement, remembering only the good TV once had to offer, and not trash those memories, delusional though they might be? But before we answer any of that, Kitty has an email to read from one of our longtime listeners. Kitty?
Okay, this is from Linda in Pennsylvania. She says, The Fugitive 2000, I awaited with much anticipation as I had the original. Back then, I could hardly wait until the Olympics were over so the fall season could start. The first two episodes were everything I could have hoped for, and I was delighted to find that Tim Daly was capable of recreating the role of Dr. Kimball to my satisfaction. Unfortunately, the role of Lieutenant Gerard left much to be desired. Michael T. Williamson just could not measure up to Barry Morse. His personal and family problems got annoying in the way, and I was very upset when they showed him using blackmail and condoning attempted murder in order to get a job where he could pursue Kimball without restraint. Nevertheless, I enjoyed seeing a far more proactive Kimball in a high-tech environment, along with a more complicated plot behind the murder and a loving relationship with Helen. Meanwhile, all the well-loved fundamental aspects of the show, such as Kimball always reaching out to help others, remained intact. I thought Tim Daly did a wonderful job with this aspect. The casting of the one-armed man more than made up for Gerard in his intensity and evil nature 40 years later. I was hooked by The Fugitive again.
What do you think?
Oh, I would definitely agree. I would also agree with you, Bob, that when I first saw previews to it, I remember thinking to myself, what can they possibly show us that they haven't already shown? Because we had 4 seasons of The Fugitive on TV, plus the movie. I mean, it seemed like they had really overdone it. But when I finally did tune in, and I didn't tune into it until towards the, mid-season, because I found out a friend of mine got to be an extra on the show, so I made a point of watching it. And after I watched that first episode, I was hooked, because I really enjoyed seeing this Kimball be very much more proactive. I liked seeing that he had had a loving relationship with his wife. I found, you know, you felt badly for his wife. I do agree about Gerard, because, you know, they took Gerard in places where it wasn't necessary. I mean, you know, I don't agree with Linda in the fact that Michael T. Williamson couldn't measure up to Barry Morse. The problem was that when they wrote Gerard for this second series, they really went into overkill. I mean, you know, because I found Barry Morse's Gerard annoying many times in the old series. But this one, they really went into overkill by trying to explain everything about Gerard's life in one season, and it wasn't necessary. And turning him into a sleazy bad guy was truly a terrible, terrible idea. But I enjoyed the characters that he came across. I enjoyed seeing the one-armed man. I mean, part of the reason I loved watching it was because Stephen Lang truly was the man you just loved to hate. I mean, it's like I didn't want to see any amount of good possibly come out of him, because he was just too fascinating to watch as this evil guy. And to create a wife for him, I think was an interesting touch. It would have been interesting to see if they would have ever brought her back, had the show continued. I think the so-called love interests that Kimball had along the way were much more interesting. And the fact that we actually saw Kimball grieving for his wife on the road, and you saw that not in isolated cases, you really saw that as kind of an underlying theme for at least the first half of the season.
Let's get Ken's thoughts on this.
Okay.
Well, mixed feelings on the 2000 series. There were ups and downs. Again, the pilot episode was all over the map. They open up with the car crash.
Now, we'll talk about the episodes on our next show, but what about the characters? Did you...
I like Daly.
Yeah.
I like Williamson. He was okay. They used him much more often, just about every week. He was in.
Yes, and that's a bad idea, in my opinion.
It was watchable for me. The one-armed man was a villain. I liked Helen Kimball, played by Rutherford.
Kelly Rutherford.
Yes, I liked her. She was perfect for the part. They had the one-armed man's wife. Thought that was a little wasted. Not much there. They had an episode on her, maybe two or three.
I have a question related to what Kitty was saying, and that is the fact that they did change some of these characters, such as having a loving relationship between Kimball and his wife, and a couple of other things. And the question is, why did they do that? Is this an admission that they did it wrong the first time? Because on the 2000 series, Roy Huggins, the creator, is still alive at that point for a few more years, and he was listed as an advisor to the show. Now, he was like well into his 80s, so whether or not they were listening to him, I don't know. But you have to wonder whether or not that's kind of a mission. How do you feel about that, Kitty? Do you think that it's just updated because it's so much later, or they saw that it could have been better in the original?
Oh, I think it's definitely that they saw that it could have been better. The fact that they had Kimball and his wife showing a loving relationship in the movie is proof of that. And, you know, and obviously they were trying to grab the people who liked the movie and bring them into the TV show. And so I think because they showed Kimball and his wife in the movie having a very nice, loving relationship, you really had to do it for the series as well. But I think it was much, much better. I mean, you truly feel bad when you see this poor woman get killed. I mean, you actually see her dying. You see her going into convulsions on the TV screen. You know, Kimball just doesn't walk into the room and see a dead woman there. I mean, he actually fights with the one-armed man. You see him trying to resuscitate his wife. it really is set up well. It's set up to be just a really, really sad tale to tell.
And the one-armed man is far more violent. You know, in the original series,
The
one-armed man is simply always walking around saying, "What, me? I didn't do anything. I don't know why he's chasing me." In the second series, the one-armed man seems to revel in the fact that he's a killer, and he kills again, and he really doesn't care.
Oh, yeah, he actually, for that show being only for one season, he killed a few people in that first season. I mean, who knows what his body count would have been had we actually gotten a few seasons down the road and ended the series.
I think that the biggest surprise has to be Tim Daly. Of course, as everybody knows, Tim Daly's father, James Daly, was in two episodes of the original series, and Tim Daly says that he, as a child, was on the set, so he was not completely unfamiliar with the series. But, you know, you had that, even though Tim Daly's made serious movies even before being in the series, it's a very strange pick, and I shook my head when I heard that, and I thought to myself, of all the people in the world you could have picked, that seems like a highly unlikely choice. And it certainly is true that the whole tone is different because he's much more proactive in trying to prove that he didn't do it. I mean, in the original series, about 80% of it is just the man running around the country trying to stay out of trouble and trying not to get arrested. Here, I mean, Tim Daly's fugitive actually is trying to prove his innocence. Ken, do you like it better that way?
Yes, I did. Did you notice he called Gerard on the phone?
Right.
Many times in
series.
So that was a twist from the old series. And
that was very bizarre. So all of those things, I mean, you know, it's hard to tinker with an original series when you bring it back. You know, there were other changes in the series, of course, because of all the inventions since then, such as cell phones and the Internet and things like that. But the characters themselves, I mean, a man falsely accused and on the run is a kind of a timeless story. You could put it in any era, really, and you'd have basically the same story. But I've always been interested in the fact that they kind of made those changes. And, I have to agree with you, Kitty. I think that they looked back and thought to themselves, you know what, it could have been done maybe just a little more realistically. And for me personally, I think that I was glad that they jettisoned that idea that Kimball and his wife were having so much marital problems. I always felt in the original series that they did that just so we would have some doubt over whether or not he really killed her or not. Don't you think that was really behind it?
Well, I don't really see how we can think that, because they showed him running into the house and she's supposedly dead. So, you know, I don't think that was really the thing. I think that they just were interested in Helen Kimball in the original series being a prop. I mean, she and the one-armed man in the original series basically are nothing more than props, from my perspective. In this series, I mean, you really learned a lot more about the one-armed man. You learned about Helen. I mean, you saw a flashback at one point about how Richard and Helen met each other. You find out the one-armed man has a wife. You find out that the one-armed man has a federal immunity code, so he can't be arrested. You find out that he's considered legally dead. Why? I mean, this is all very intriguing, you know, it just plays out much better than just this vagrant type guy running from Kimball.
All right, it's much more interesting. We've got to take a quick time out. The election season is upon us, and so we have a paid political ad that we need to get in, and then we'll be back to continue talking Fugitive 2000 here on Retro Radio.
Take a look at corruption. You know, it ranges all the way from petty political larceny to grand government theft. And as far as corruption is concerned, I want to make this one point very clear. I worked for the government for 9 months during 1942. Mrs. Nixon worked for the government in San Francisco while I was in service overseas. I am proud of the fact that I once worked for the federal government. I am proud of the millions of fine, good, honest, decent, loyal people that work for the federal government. And I say that the best thing that can be done for them is to kick out the crooks and the others that have besmirched their reputations in Washington, D.C., and that's what we're going to do.
Select the Eisenhower-Nixon team on November 4th.
That Nixon-Eisenhower team is looking better and better and better all the time, I got to admit. Okay, and the next edition of Talking Fugitive will be on election night, November 4th, and I think it promises to be a lot more interesting than that election. Okay, Fugitive 2000, enough political discussion. Let's get back to important stuff with Bobby Neer.
Okay, you've made a believer out of me so far. You've shown you can go home again with new actors portraying classic characters and not get laughed out of town. But so what? What now? Kimmel went free at the end of the original series, so what is left? Do we just crank it all up and do all the best stories again? We all know they ran out of ideas after three seasons. And what about the world? Law enforcement methods are 10 times better than they once were, to say nothing of DNA testing, the internet, cell phones, and instant communication. How can anybody possibly hide in plain sight now? The Fugitive 2000, Part 2, an old story in a new era, the most memorable episodes, 2 weeks from tonight on Talking Fugitive. One thing that distinguishes the new 2000 Fugitive is its non-dependence on those main characters. They seem to have learned something and decided not to totally burn out the main actors as they had done previously. Now we have a rather long and impressive cast of recurring characters that we never heard of before, such as a young computer geek named Chuck Brixius, who has been following the Kimball case from day one. Matthew Ross, Helen Kimball's very rich father, who believes that Richard is guilty of killing his daughter. A bounty hunter named Carl Vasek set upon Kimball as if Gerard isn't enough. The one-armed man actually has a wife now named Renee, and she's almost as bad as he is. An insurance investigator named Buddy LaRue, who comes to a very bad end. And one very special love interest for Richard Kimball, a woman named Jenny, and their involvement in a far more graphically displayed sexual encounter that we ever saw back in the 60s. We have very limited time to cover all of these, but let's at least try to make a few comments on each of them. Kitty, let's start with Chuck Brixius, a character I think everybody really loved and admired for his efforts to save Richard Kimball. Who is he, and what is he trying to do?
Well, basically, he's a computer geek. We never really find out what happened to him, other than you kind of get, it's kind of hinted at that he was hospitalized in a mental institution for a while. But he's really smart, and he saved Kimball from the police in South Carolina, I believe it was. And he actually has set up a website called drrichardkimball.com where people send in tips. He posted Ben Charnquist's picture on that website.
Did he actually solicit on there and ask Kimball to get in touch with him?
Yes, he did. He did do that. He actually, at one point, he put a message on there saying that his father was dying. The person who actually put a solicitation on there saying to get in touch with her was actually Helen's sister, Becca Ross. I mean, this was another character that we saw. We saw Helen's sister in the original series, you know, as kind of this lovesick teenager who had always had a crush on Kimball. But in the Fugitive 2000, we actually saw a very interesting character in that of Becca Ross, where she was actually trying to help clear Kimball. You know, she was very proactive too in trying to help him. So, you know, we just had a lot more interesting characters, and don't forget we even saw an ex-girlfriend of Kimball's at one point.
Right.
Well.
Yeah. That story though was, you know, that didn't do much for me. Ken, you like this idea of this this kid, Chuck, trying to help from the outside?
Yes, I just watched the series recently. You sent me the tapes in the mail.
Right.
And it was a good storyline. They used them maybe 5, 6, 7 times over. I always, in the back of my mind, wondered if he was going to turn out to betray Kimball. But that,
well, that would have been an interesting thing to do, wouldn't it?
Oh, I couldn't imagine.
I never thought about that.
They did have a meeting, too. I like that. Daly Daly's character met up with him one time, and then Gerard was outside the door. Remember
exactly,
that?
Right, right.
So it was all right. I liked it.
Okay, let's skip from there to Jenny. You know, in the original series, of course, we know the various girlfriends that Richard Kimball had. They all turned out to be one-night stands because he always had to move on, obviously. And now we have a woman named Jenny. Actually, they pretty much put everything into this one encounter. And, Kitty, I think you'll agree with me. This really reflects that it's the year 2000 because he doesn't waste any time in hopping into bed with her, does he?
No, not really. You know, he does have a tryst with her, and he considers just staying there. I mean, to a certain degree, it kind of takes you back to the episode Never Wave Goodbye in the original series. But in this instance, Richard actually had a real reason to stay, because unlike in the 1963 version, Richard Kimball didn't get to have sex with Karen, whereas in this one, he got to have sex with Jenny.
Well, the most that ever happened in Never Wave Goodbye was that Karen got to sit in his lap for 3 seconds.
Yeah, yeah.
That's about as hot as that guy.
But, you know, it was an interesting episode, but for me, I ended up, it was a two-part episode.
Right.
The second part is when they get taken hostage by these two psychotic things.
Yeah, well, I like that part.
I mean, it was interesting, but by the same token, I kind of didn't like Jenny as much after that because she seemed kind of wimpy. When you think of how the other women he had encountered up to that point had dealt with tricky situations, that were violent. I mean, I know you said you didn't think much of his ex-girlfriend, Jean Trabant, but that woman had the guts to pick up a shovel hit Carl Vasek over the head with it and speed off in her car with Kimball.
Well, you know, we all know, of course, that we have to go to Ken about Jenny because he's going to tell me right now that she doesn't even come close to Karen, right, Ken?
You'll be surprised. Are you ready, Bob?
I won't be surprised. Go ahead.
Part one of the Jenny episode is my favorite one in the 2000 series.
Really?
Out of all of them. Part two was a disaster with the hostage.
Oh, I like that part.
Oh, that was awful.
Is Jenny on that wall?
Jenny? No, she's not on the wall. But you know what? That was a genuine story. And I didn't consider her wimpy. She was a tough character.
Oh, I thought she was wimpy because at the end when Richard came running back to save her and then the psycho woman had the gun on Jenny, he comes up through that laundry chute.
Oh, yeah.
And he's fighting with that woman for the gun. Jenny's just kind of standing in the background doing nothing when she could have picked up a lamp
and
hit
her
net over the head with it.
But she was not a dysfunctional figure like we've seen in the original series.
Well, see, I'm not entirely sure about that. I mean, she has
this thing.
She wasn't
wacky.
Well, but think about it. I mean, this is a woman, she said she was a career woman. The bed and breakfast was her husband's thing. She lived apart from her husband and her child during the week while they were at the bed and breakfast. She worked in the city as a software person. And I mean, I remember as I was watching that and I was thinking to myself, this doesn't really sound, and not only that, she couldn't cook to save her life. This did not seem like the kind of...
Oh, why? Just because she took frozen dinners and put them on the table while they were still frozen?
Yeah, I mean, this did not come across to me like the kind of woman Kimball would be attracted to in under normal circumstances. And I always felt like, you know, he said, okay, I'll stay. But I always kind of got the impression that if he, you know, had there not been a show and had two bank robbers not shown up, I think that I always got the impression that he would have gotten bored with her after a while, because this just, you know, he doesn't seem like the kind of guy that wanted to be, that if he was a practicing doctor and had to pull 36-hour shifts to come home to a woman who the best she could offer him was a half-frozen TV dinner or take-out Chinese.
You know what? I can't get away from this without mentioning this to Ken, which is that, Ken, I'm sure you feel like I do, that doing that very graphic sex scene, at least graphic for TV, it made you really wonder what that would have looked like if only he had gotten that far with Karen. Well, we could have gotten to see Ray up undressed. We never got that far.
But don't you remember, though, Karen was soaking wet on the rocks.
Yeah, but she had her clothes on. I mean, Jenny gets he gets to take her clothes off, period.
He gave her a nice smooch on the rock.
Yeah, but still, you know, I'm looking at Jenny and I'm thinking to myself, oh, if only it had been Karen. But he can't have everything, I guess.
And the other thing, too, that I, you know, because I looked at this from the standpoint of would Kimball want to be with this woman if he was just your regular doctor and didn't have this murder conviction hanging over him? And I really just could not see him with a woman who had the priority of, okay, honey, you keep the kid and I'll go off to the city for the week and do my thing with the software company. That to me just seemed very strange. I mean, she came across to me as a woman who didn't seem to know what her priorities should be. I mean, I you know, certainly I felt empathy for her because her husband and her son had died in that terrible accident, but you know, she, you know, for a woman who was so devastated that she lost her husband and her kid, it seems like she should have maybe devoted a little more time to her husband and her kid when they were alive.
Kenny, let me interrupt here because we've only got a couple of minutes left. I want to get, before we run out of time, to one other woman that was very important and very different, and that was the one-armed man who has a wife named Renee.
Oh, yeah.
And boy, is she ever bad. She's, if I remember correctly, she's trying to collect an insurance policy, right?
She did. She collected the insurance money on Ben, and I don't really know how it is that Buddy LaRue from the insurance company suspected that Ben Charnquist was still alive, but he did, and that's how he ended up in New Orleans at the same time as Kimball, because he was investigating Renee. But yeah, Renee, you know, if anybody had a theme song, it would be for Renee, it would be the song Bad to the Bone, because she basically she's out for herself. As I watch this, it's like, what made her marry this psychopath named Charnquist? But obviously Charnquist, you didn't find this out because the series was so short, but obviously he had some kind of connections, obviously, that helped get her in somewhere. But yeah, she was, and you know, and at the end you see her at a safety deposit box with all kinds of money.
Well, it's interesting to see these other characters brought into the series, and you know what, if they had done any of this in the original series, they might not have gotten to the end of season three, actually, and had a totally wiped out David Janssen, who, you know, decided that the fourth season was going to be the last one, because he was just totally out of it by that time. And it just goes to show you how much TV has changed over the years, because today almost everything on TV is like this. There are characters everywhere, and there's just no single character that really runs a show. And that's how they run so long. I mean, that's why you got shows that have been on for 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 years. They just completely burned out David Janssen. I mean, I guess when he signed on for the series, it probably looked pretty good, but if you look down the road and you see yourself in virtually every script and every scene, you're going to wonder if you're going to live long enough to get to the end of the series. Now, you know, so you can see by these multi characters here that this is a chance to spread it around.
All right, and spread it around you have, and we'll be back spreading it around in 2 weeks. On November the 4th, it'll be part two of The Fugitive 2000. Hope all of you will join us then here on Sheravision Radio.